Tucker, that is. Hot, humid, a chance for showers today. Then they're saying mostly dry throughout the 4th of July weekend, but I would have to believe there's that ever-present chance of a shower here or there. David Schultz joins us now, professor of political science at Hamline University, to talk about the big, beautiful bill. But before we do, David, I got to ask you this. You're a well-read man, a learned man, a scholar, a professor of law, a professor of political science. You were in the soundproof booth, so you couldn't hear the question I posed earlier, which is, when I say Dalai Lama, you immediately think what?
Peace.
Oh, well, I was going to go with Caddyshack. Anyway, let's go talk about the big...
I hadn't thought about that film in years. That's right.
Big hitter, the Dalai Lama. Big off the
table. That's right.
Big hitter. Anyway, let's talk about... what's going on with the big, beautiful bill and the Senate and what's in it and what happens from here, and jump in where you feel comfortable.
Okay, so it's passed both the House and the Senate, but as required by the Constitution, it has to pass in the exact same form in both the House and the Senate. And there are differences in terms of things such in terms of some tax issues regarding Social Security, TIPS, cuts to Medicaid, a variety of things. Remember, this is a huge bill. It's over 900 pages long. So what's happening now is that the bill will go to what's called a conference committee. And the conference committee is composed of members of the House and the Senate, and they'll try to iron out the differences to reach an agreement. Once they've reached an agreement in this conference committee, then it has to go back to the House for another vote and back to the Senate for another vote. And assuming both the House and the Senate do pass the bill now in the exact same form, it would go to Donald Trump's desk for signature.
Now, the conference committee is not working in a vacuum. They're constantly communicating with the Senate or the House to see what's acceptable and what's not, right?
Absolutely correct at this point. And this is where it becomes, I'd say, I mean, if the politics wasn't interesting before, now it becomes even more interesting, because the pass in each of the respective houses, House of Representatives and the Senate, the Republicans had to play, and I don't mean this in a bad sense, had to play the politics. They had to, you know, maybe give one thing to one member of Congress, one House member who was kind of like not sure about what to vote, whether they're going to vote for it or support it, give something to somebody else. In the House of Representatives, they had to balance it between the more moderate Republicans who are concerned about some cuts to Medicaid versus some in the Freedom Caucus who wanted even more cuts. They had to balance those who were concerned about the deficit versus those who wanted more more spending. So each chamber, these were very close votes. Remember, it passed by what I think like one vote, I think in the one or two votes in the House. It was 50-50 deadlocked in the Senate, which meant the vice president got to cast the deciding vote. These are going to be tough negotiations. Now, do I think they're eventually going to work it out? I do. I mean, it's still within one party, and the president's putting lots of pressure on. Whether it happens before 4th of July, I don't know, but it's going to be difficult negotiations as the conference committee is listening to and feeling the pressure from the rest of the members of from Congress. And quite frankly, the lobbyists are going to still be there. They're going to be pushing one more time.
So where does the 4th of July deadline fit in all of this? Is that an artificial deadline? What happens if they don't do it by the 4th of July?
It's an artificial deadline. I mean, Donald Trump, president, basically said, I want this to my desk by July 4th. I mean, there's no legal consequences whatsoever, which means if they don't get it done until the 5th or the 6th or something like that, all right, they've missed the deadline, but they still passed the legislation. I think Trump wants it for the 4th for symbolic reasons, passing on the 4th. And probably the members of Congress would like to be able to get out of town for a couple of days and celebrate the 4th of July weekend also.
So I got a neighbor that's on Social Security but is also concerned about debt and deficit, and he was against this big, beautiful bill until he found out that there was a provision to not tax Social Security. Then he was for it. Does that kind of mirror the way the American public looks at this thing, where everybody's concerned about debt or deficit until it relates to them, and if they get a break, then screw it, let's kick it down the road?
Yeah, I think it's exactly sort of the problem, not just with this bill, but one could make the argument this has been the problem for American politics for however many years, is that on the one hand, people will say they support or oppose something, but then when they realize they're going to get some goodie out of it, well, suddenly it becomes a really good idea. Lisa Murkowski, who was a U.S. Senator from Alaska, was very much concerned about the debt issues. But when the Senate said, well, we'll give you some special breaks that just apply to people for the state of Alaska, nowhere else, she suddenly said, boy, what a really good bill, or at least enough there that I want to support it now. And I think that's how the American public is that they're seeing little bits of things that will help them out on one level. The question becomes, and this is a complex, very complex, so you win a few things, but you also have to calculate what you've lost. And I just don't think most Americans, and I'm not picking on Americans for saying this, in a 900-page bill that deals with literally hundreds, if not thousands, of different items, that they can do the calculus and say, on balance, this is what I like or dislike.
Well, my neighbor evaluated it strictly from the standpoint of he doesn't have to pay taxes on Social Security, so therefore he was for it. And that just amazed me how he turned around on it so quickly. Mm-hmm. And it just, I thought, you know what, man, that's pretty much the American way there. When it comes to Murkowski, she got what she wanted, but let's talk about Susan Collins, because I thought she was looking for some stuff and didn't get it as it relates to rural hospitals, so that's why she voted no.
Exactly the case. And that's going to be one of the things to look at down the line here now, too, is two things. One, with Susan Collins, to what extent is she now on the scut list with the president, and how does it play out going forward? Second, I think you bring up a very interesting point here, is that the evidence is suggesting at this point that rural hospitals are going to take a massive hit in the United States. And we're already seeing lots of those hospitals closing. I don't know if your state is similar to mine, but there's a lot of counties in Minnesota at this point that have so depopulated that either the rural hospitals have closed up, or I point out to my students, there's at least a dozen counties in the state where they can't deliver a baby. I mean, this, you know, so if you're living there, you have to go to another county. They don't have good emergency rooms. So that's going to be something to think about down the line there in terms of the impact on rural healthcare delivery. And going back to the Social Security issue, I think a report came out about a week or so ago that Social Security is going to default, you know, I think, what, 1 year earlier than they thought in just the next few years. And cutting Social Security taxes, according to economists, is just going to make that default even greater, likelihood greater down the line.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, about the big, beautiful bill. You can text me at 504-260-1870. Are you for it or against it? Are you concerned with debt and deficit and it adding $3 trillion or $4 trillion, I think it is, to the debt? Or are you more concerned about what's in it for you? And like my neighbors that said, you know what, I have to pay taxes on Social Security. Hell yeah, I'm for it. Or like Murkowski from Alaska, who said, well, if you're going to throw me a little bit of wet my beak a little bit, sure, I'm for it as well. 504-260-1870. Please, no texting or driving. While you're driving, 621 traffic now, WWL. 626, Tommy Tucker, WWL. That, of course, President Trump talking about the big, beautiful bill, saying there's something in it for everybody. Is there something in it for people that are concerned with debt and deficit? David Schultz, our guest, professor of political science at Hamline University.
Not really, because all the estimates are it's going to add between $3 and $4 trillion to the U.S. debt. And if you're concerned about debt and what obligations we have to our children and our grandchildren down the line, it's not the bill that you want to support. But also keep in mind at this point now, just to put it in perspective, how much we're paying on interest on the debt, because somebody has to pay for it, is that our interest on the debt now is about the same amount of money that we're spending on the U.S. military budget per year. So by the time this passes, we'll be paying out about $1 trillion a year just on interest on the debt. And just to make it kind of like a parallel here, it's like people making the minimum payment on a credit card where we all know this, what happens here. If you don't pay down the principal, you just keep paying off on the on the interest.
Right.
You essentially never pay off your credit card or takes forever to do it. That's really where we are at this point right now.
So the politics of this is that there's something in there for everybody, as the president said, which makes everybody happy, I guess, for the midterms coming up. Or maybe it doesn't.
Right.
I don't know. But at some point, either debt and deficit are greatly over-exaggerated, or at some point the chickens are going to come home to roost, and whoever's in office at the time, when the whole thing comes tumbling down, is going to pay the cost of this. Am I wrong there politically or not?
No, you're absolutely correct here. I mean, this is the proverbial kicking the can down the road yet again. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things we've been doing that on. We've been doing that on the debt. We've been doing that on Social Security, on Medicaid, a whole bunch of things that if you look at really good reports, we have, you know, significant insolvencies. Now, somebody says at one point, well, it doesn't really matter. We'll just kick it down the line. That all they have to do is pay interest on it. Well, this is where it's going to have an impact in terms of if our debt gets to be so high and there's questions about our ability to pay it back, we'll see our debt, our credit rating go down. And that happened a few months ago where Moody's brought it down, which means we now have to pay investors more money, higher bond rates to be able to induce them to buy bonds. And so it just kind of creates this cycle in terms of indebtedness, both presently and down the line.
So this increases the debt or deficit by how much is Bill?
The deficit, you know, which is the total amount of money we collectively owe, by about $3 to $4 trillion. Now, remember, deficit is different than debt. I mean, we have a deficit every year, which means we're paying out more than we're bringing in, and that's creating the national debt, which is how much money we overall owe.
So if the Democrats were to be the ones passing this bill, and I'm just trying to keep this honest here, I would think the Republicans would be screaming to high heaven about debt and deficit.
They would be labeled as tax and spend liberals.
So how are the Republicans then justifying this addition to debt and deficit?
That's probably something people need to go talk to the Republican Party about. I think the basic argument is really something that goes back to the Reagan era, which is really some kind of variation of trickle down, is that we make these cuts right now and it'll eventually benefit us all and it'll spur all kinds of growth in our society and our economy, that we won't miss all these things that were cut and we'll eventually be able to pay off our debts.
Has that worked yet?
Not in my lifetime.
Okay. Thank you, David. Appreciate your time. Professor of Political Science at Hamline University, David Schultz. And look, I get it. Y'all are texting in. I get it. Those that are Democrats hate the bill. Those that are Republicans love the bill. I think the truth is that this is very complicated with so many offshoots. Who can tell what's going to happen, what's not going to happen? I do know that historically the debt and deficit has done nothing but gone up, both parties, Republican and Democrat. And at some point, we'll probably have to pay for that. We're going to talk about an invasive species of insect when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. We are back, 6:45, quarter till 7. We may connect with Aaron Ashbrook, an assistant professor of peri-urban entomology at LSU, about a new invasive species of ants that was spotted near Baton Rouge. And I'm not talking about ants like the one in the Geico commercial with, you know, ant this and ant that. But anyway, so we'll see what happens. Somebody texted in about the big, beautiful bill. You didn't have a problem with all the trillions Biden wasted. Name one thing Biden did for the American people, not a damn thing. Yeah, you know, what's interesting about this text is that, first of all, I criticize Biden a lot, and so you don't know what I did or didn't do, so that's a false presumption. Secondly, I'm constantly hawking on debt and deficit and how it's going to eventually bring the country down and how important it is. And the other thing about this text that gets me is that it's all about winning and losing and our team and their team and Biden. What the hell does Biden have to do with anything? Biden's gone. Biden. I don't know that Biden's known what day it's been for the last 6 years. And you're talking about what Biden, what's that got to do with the big, beautiful bill? It's not a zero sum game. It's like, what about the future of the country and where do we go from here with debt and deficit? And are you concerned about your kids or your grandkids? Because at some point, the chickens are going to come home to roost. And the people that are in office at the time are the ones that are going to get blamed for it. And look out what happens to them when the economy crashes. But meanwhile, the people that are in office continue to do what they do, and that is increase the debt and deficit to give people what they want, i.e. my neighbor with, he was against the big, beautiful bill until he found out there was no tax on Social Security. And by the way, he had come out against tax on, what do you mean no tax on tips? Yeah, they got to pay tax on tips until he found out there was no tax on Social Security. Then all of a sudden he fell in line and said, oh, well, wait a minute now, hang on a second, maybe that is a big, beautiful bill. So the only point I'm thinking is, at least be honest. Don't look at it from either win or lose. It's red or blue, Biden this, Trump that. Look at what each person does individually and forget who they are, forget what party they represent, I would think, and see if it's the best thing for the country. So still nothing on a guest. I guess that means we're going to go to the who are you game. That's our go-to whenever we have a guest that doesn't show up. We play who are you, and to be clear, we have no prizes. This is not a competition at all. This is an exhibition. All you have to do is text in your answer at 504-260-1870. If you think you know who this is, and I'll see if you're right or not. No texting and driving. It's the Oklahoma Jeweler Talk and Text Line, of course, as always, no texting and driving. The Who providing the background music. So, again, this is not a contest. We're not giving anything away. We're just having a little bit of fun on July 2nd. You're going to hear a soundbite from a movie clip, and you can tell me who it is. You can tell me the character they're playing. Or you can tell me the movie that it's from. Either way, what we're trying to find out is, who are you? Among the guests that have come in, Donald Trump, first time he lit a fireplace. No, that's not right. Everybody else said Castaway, that it was Tom Hanks from Castaway, and I thought that would be a tough one, but apparently not so much. Let's go to the National Weather Service now and talk to Bridget Lim. How you doing, Bridget?
Hi, I'm fine, thank you. How about you?
I'm okay. Let's talk about the weather for the 4th of July weekend. Typical July, drier than usual, hotter than usual. What are we looking at?
So for today, it'll be kind of like the typical summer where you'll have like thunderstorms in the afternoon, but it'll actually be a bit drier this weekend.
Any reason for that?
We're just getting a little bit of drier air just because there's a little bit of a tropical system to our east. There's no threat to us in terms of like any tropical systems, but it's kind of just bringing in some drier air.
So let's talk about that tropical system to the east, because people are going to Florida, might be going to the beach, and first of all, I get confused with the Florida Panhandle, because I think you could make a case that either part of the Florida could be the Panhandle, don't you think? Don't you, really? It would seem like you could either have the top part as the Panhandle or the other part, but either way, what for people that are headed to Florida this weekend, what kind of weather are they looking at? And take us from, say, all the way east down to Miami.
So maybe around Pensacola in that area, there may be a bit higher chance of rain and showers and thunderstorms, just because like there's a bit of a low that's trying to spin up in that that system that I mentioned earlier, so there might be a little more rain than normal. But as of right now, I don't think it would be causing any actual tropical systems.
So rain, if you go on a Destin or that kind of area, what can you expect weather-wise? Because a lot of people are going.
Yeah, so it's going to be like for the weekend itself, like the actual Independence Day, mm-hmm. It'll be nice. It'll be sunny, but on either edge, you might have a couple chances of showers and thunderstorms.
All right,
I think the bigger thing right now is it's going to be actually quite hot, like high temperatures in the mid-90s.
Mm. So as you turn at Lake City and head south toward Disney World and those kind of things, what about people heading to Orlando and amusement parks and those kind of areas? What can they look forward to? Same thing?
Yeah, let me double-check on that, but let's see. Yeah, I would say it's a similar thing where the biggest concern is definitely going to be the heat. Like, it's going to be mid-90s, and on top of the dew points, it's going to feel like well into the hundreds in terms of the feel-like temperature.
Mm-hmm.
But once you get into the later in the weekend, like Saturday and Sunday, that's when the increased chance of showers and thunderstorms are going to pop up, like, you know, in the 40% range.
Mm-hmm. So here we are in the second week of second month, rather, of hurricane season. I always try to go 7 to 10 days at a time. I know we got Saharan dust in the area. Looking out into the Caribbean or the Gulf or the Atlantic, wherever you have to look, do you see any type of development, or what are they saying about the all clear for how long?
So other than that little system that's kind of straddling between Florida and the southeast Atlantic states, I'm not seeing anything in the longer term right now, so we'll keep our fingers crossed, but always make sure you're ready to go, have your supplies ready, double-check your plans, because it only takes one to really mess things up.
Right, but you could say with some certainty for the next 7 days everything's good?
Yeah, for the next 7 days, I would say for Louisiana, yes.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Bridget Lim with the National Weather Service. We're going to take a break for the news in a minute. And when we do, when we come back, rather, we're going to talk to, hopefully, Meet Allison, a professor in Tulane University's Department of River Coastal Science and Engineering. Parts of the New Orleans area are sinking faster than originally thought. That's not good. And faster than other parts of the area. That's not good. And that's potentially bad news for our flood protection system, which, again, is not good. Then we're going to talk to Tim Poche, CEO of Delta Utilities. They're taking over as a natural gas provider in New Orleans. We'll talk about what customers can expect and what they need to know. And then we're going to talk to Ronald Surpass, professor of practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD superintendent, head of the Washington State Police, Nashville City Police. We talk to him every Wednesday morning, pick his brain about crime. We're at the halfway point of the year. Violent crime so far has been down to 2024, despite the violent start with the terrorist attack on New Year's Day. We'll talk about that. Knox Ross will join us, chairman of the Southern Rail Commission, talking about taking a train from New Orleans to Mobile. Not that expensive to do it. I don't know if you do it or not, but it might be something fun to do. Walter Dublane Jones joins us after that, associate professor of economics and finance at UNO. Talk about the big, beautiful bill and cuts to Medicaid and what that means to Louisianians, because it might sound good on one hand, but then again, you might be rooting for something that's going to hurt you. So we'll talk about that. And then we're going to talk with NOPD about ankle monitors to follow up on our conversation that we had with Matt Dennis from ASAP yesterday. So a lot coming up. I'm Tommy Tucker. Stay with us. WWL. All right, 7:13, Tommy Tucker. Unfortunately, the world is moving down in this part of the world. It seems as though Meet Allison joins us now, professor in Tulane University's Department of River Coastal Science and Engineering. Morning, professor. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing all right. How are you doing, Tom?
I'm okay. I was doing better till I read this. Tell me what's going on with sinking. I don't even know how you determine. I don't know how you want to start telling the story, professor, because first of all, you got to determine that this is happening, right? Tell me what you found, and then we'll talk about the methodology.
Right. I mean, this is a satellite that basically fires a radar at the Earth's surface and passes over Louisiana every 12 days. Mm-hmm. And so you sort of build up. It gives you the elevation of the ground surface every 12 days. And so over about a five-year period, we accumulated the images. And then you can look at changes in ground elevation over that period is basically the methodology behind it.
So the constant is where the satellite is. It fires the radar beam, and that's how you get the measurement, correct, to see what?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically just it measures the distance from the satellite to the Earth's surface, and it's a pretty highly accurate measurement down to a fraction of an inch, and, okay, and it's just the repetition. So any point on the Earth's surface, you can actually see, you can develop a time series of how ground elevation may change. The difficult part of it is, of course, how do you interpret that ground elevation change? So it could be some sort of subsurface geologic process, or it could be, you know, you're building a new neighborhood, and so you're piling up soil in order to raise the elevation, and and that ground elevation change is measured. So one of the things, for instance, we found was, you know, lots of changes out where they built the new terminal at New Orleans Airport, and some of that was, you know, the soil addition and then the compaction of that material after the terminal was built. And so the interpretation is the tricky bit in this.
That's I'm blown away by this. That amazes me that technology exists. So even to the point of seeing if a neighborhood is being built or developed, building up the land there to raise the elevation, this satellite can tell that.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. It's a ground elevation change, but there are a lot of things, as you know, that can either change to and make the ground go up or make the ground go down. But one of the things, of course, we were interested in is subsidence in the subsurface and trying to link it to that particular causality.
Which means sinking. Tell me what you found.
Well, I mean, there are hot spots underneath places where there is groundwater withdrawal. So a lot of industrial processes around the region will pull out groundwater for things like cooling in their in their factories, and so you're pulling down groundwater. You actually cause a cone of subsidence, sort of a circular feature around the structure. So we see a number of those things. One of the cool things we found is that an earlier study had seen that under the old Entergy power plant out at Michoud, and they stopped pulling groundwater, and actually the ground began to recover in elevation, is what we saw during our period, which runs from 2016 to 2020. So it's kind of cool. Some of this stuff is actually recoverable if you deplete groundwater and then you put it back, or nature puts it back after you stop pumping it. You can see some of the ground return, not fully, but at least partially return in elevation. So that was a cool study. Probably the most consequential thing that's gotten all the media attention is that, you know, our period is immediately after the construction of the new protection system around the region, the Histris, they call it. Mm-hmm. And so we were able to measure for the first time rates along the flood walls and levees around the system.
Between a period of when and when?
2016 to 2020. So that's one of the interesting things. We found some areas that seem to be going down pretty fast, on the order of more than an inch a year. But this is almost immediately after the construction of these structures. And so the question is this something that's natural settlement after construction, or is this something that's going to be a long-term subsidence of certain sections of these flood walls? And that sort of remains to be seen. But again, it's now, some of this data is now 5 years old.
So, like, what flood walls are you talking about specifically, or all of them?
Well, I mean, there are certain sections. It'd be hard to describe each one, but mm-hmm. Certain sections seem to be very stable, and certain sections seem to be going down. So it's very much a patchwork around the system.
So I'm going to expose my ignorance here, Professor, but it would seem like, you know, I'm a logic guy, not a science guy, but it would seem like if some areas are sinking and others aren't, well, then maybe it's not natural compaction, or it would depend on where the thing was built in the first place to see if it compacted or not, the sinkage?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly a possibility. There is one section where we were able to measure the wetlands that surrounded it, and those wetlands are going down, and so is the flood wall on top of it, which would exactly lead you to the conclusion that there's some sort of underlying geologic control, and it's not just settlement of the material. We're just trying to be careful not to, you know, jump to conclusions about the causality of this. It's really more, the value of this is it's a snapshot of the whole system during a 5 year period. And you hand that over to people like the flood authority and say, you know, do you want to explore this further or make further measurements or try and explore what the causes behind it are?
To be clear, this is from the satellite to the land or to the structure. It's not a comparison of sea level, because sea level rise is happening, but it's got nothing to do with this. This is strictly about the elevation of the land, right, regardless of sea level rise?
Yeah, I mean, this is, but again, it amounts to the same thing, right? When you're talking about a flood wall and its level of protection from a storm surge, you can reduce the level of protection by the ocean coming up, or you can reduce the level of protection by the protection structure going down. So this is sort of a compounding thing to sea level rise, if it's if and where it's occurring.
That's the way I looked at it. It's like this is in addition to sea level rise. It's not a comparison to. The ground doesn't appear lower because the sea level's rising. The ground is lower and the sea level's rising as well, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And so we refer to that as relative sea level rise, which is a combination of the two. And in this case, some of our rates were 3 to 5 times higher than the rate that the ocean is coming up.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. Y'all got any questions? 504-260-1870. Open our jeweler talk and text line. Please don't text and drive. I'll pass them along to Professor Mead Allison when we come back. Professor in Tulane University's Department of River Coastal Sciences and Engineering, talking about parts of the New Orleans area sinking faster than originally thought. And, okay, we know it now. What do we do about it? 721 traffic, WWL. 726, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Professor Mead Allison. He's in Tulane University's Department of River Coastal Science and Engineering, talking about some of the parts of the New Orleans area sinking faster than originally thought. Professor, what do we do about this? Or do you just pass the information on? Is there any way? First of all, let me ask you this, and this is a dumb question, but I'll ask it anyway. Sinking into what? Because you'd think there's only so much compaction, right? Or when we talk about the earth and the core and what happens underneath the aquifer, take me through all that, would you please? The water table?
Well, how much time do we have? I mean,
I'm here till 10, so if you...
Go ahead. The point is we're sitting on top of the Delta, and subsidence is a fact of life, right? It's thousands of years of sediment, and they're self-compacting, and it... You know, even when you stop loading them with more sediment, they continue to compact. So it's a natural process that we're involved in living in New Orleans on top of a delta. But the fact that certain areas are subsiding more quickly than others, I think that's where we need to do a little more research and try and figure out what the cause is behind it.
So is it something that we're doing? That's my question, or not? Because, for example, and that's, I don't mean to get you going down to the Earth's core or anything like that, but when it comes to other areas in bedrock, we don't have any bedrock here, and that's why everything's sinking. Or do areas that have bedrock, do they sink as well or not?
Well, yeah, I mean, we've got bedrock many thousands of feet down, right? But we have a lot of soft sediment.
We do?
We have a lot of soft sediment sitting on top of that that's very water-rich. And so, we do have more typical subsidence problems than most places on Earth.
So there is, like, when you get to areas where they have to excavate and explode out rock to put in houses or buildings or foundations or whatever— ultimately, if you dig deep enough here, you will find that?
Yeah, but you're talking many thousands of feet to get down to a bedrock. There's a lot of Mississippi River sediment piled up out there.
I didn't realize that. So let's talk about then, what do the people with this information, what do they do with it? Does it mean that do you watch it from years ahead, or do you track it? Do you automatically plan on, with the sea levels rising and the area sinking, do you plan on, well, what we did is not good enough?
Well, I mean, I think in terms of the flood protection system, the state is required, is my understanding, to do regular recertification surveys. You recall this, one in 100 year storm level of protection. And of course, if the ocean is rising or the flood walls are sinking, that level of protection is going to be incrementally degraded. And so they are required to recertify, and presumably would raise levels of levees and flood walls if necessary in order to maintain that level of protection. So we just turn that information over to folks like the Flood Authority for their own use. The beauty of this technique is that it's a snapshot where you can do the whole system in one look, but it's not as accurate as somebody going out there and measuring at the ground surface all the way around the system and tracking it from year to year. So I don't know exactly the level of ground-based tracking that the Flood Authority is doing, but I presume they are doing it, and this will be useful information to them in their regular recertifications.
Just out of curiosity, you know your stuff. Would you ever build a house here that was not on pilings?
On pilings?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's hard in New Orleans, right? We did that up on the lakefront in the post-war period and had a lot of problems with cracking foundations, and so until you started putting pilings under the foundations, it's a tough place to build homes without some sort of getting down to more stable sediment to build your house on.
Thank you, Professor. Very interesting. I appreciate your time. Hope you have a nice 4th of July weekend. We'll take a break, come back, talk about Delta Utilities being the natural gas provider in New Orleans. Right now, time for WWL First News. 743, 17 till 8, joined by Tim Poche, CEO of Delta Utilities. More about that in a second. How you doing, Tim?
Good morning, Tommy. How are you doing?
I'm well. I got to ask, everybody's got a story. I got to believe when you were 7 years old when your parents said, "So, Timmy, what do you want to be when you grow up?" You didn't say CEO of Delta Utilities, did you?
Not hardly. It's been a long journey, though. Interestingly enough, I did start my career 35 years ago in New Orleans, and have lived all over the country, and now 35 years later, back here living in New Orleans, and it's great to be home.
How did you get into the business? And again, I'm not trying to pry into your personal life, Tim, but I know everybody has a story. How'd you get into the business of being, how does one become CEO of Delta Utilities?
Well, I spent the first part of my career in public accounting, and I served a number of utilities all over the country, including Entergy and CenterPoint, and really got to know and understand and love and appreciate that industry. In the last 10 years of my career, I've been working in private equity, and now the two worlds have been married, and great to be back here in New Orleans and leading this business here for our customers and our community.
So tell me about Delta Utilities.
So we are a Louisiana-born, New Orleans-based natural gas utility, exclusively focused on natural gas. And yesterday we completed a transaction where we acquired Entergy's natural gas assets, which were roughly 200,000 customers in Baton Rouge and New Orleans. And previously, in April of this year, we had acquired CenterPoint Energy's natural gas distribution business in Louisiana and Mississippi. So in total, we're serving about 600,000 customers across two states. We're the largest natural gas provider in Louisiana, and very excited to serve our customers and our communities within this region.
I'm trying to remember. Historically, it was New Orleans Public Service that was providing natural gas, and then Entergy took it over. Is that right or not?
Yes, that was a transaction a number of years ago, but mm-hmm. New Orleans Public Service, as you probably recall, was providing electricity, natural gas, and streetcar service mm-hmm. at the time, and public transportation. So Entergy has been a great steward of that business. We're very happy to take over an outstanding workforce of 200 people that serve the customers, and they joined the 500 other people that we had acquired through the previous transaction, and 200 people here in our headquarters, and we're very excited to serve the community here.
Tim, if you can, take me through how somebody in Orleans Parish turns on the gas, right on the oven or the heater, what have you, and it comes on. What has to be done? How does Delta get it from wherever it is to into their house? Take me through that process, would you please?
Yeah, so we have probably roughly 18,000 miles through our service territory of natural gas main lines, and we have various connections, city gates, what we refer to them, where we procure natural gas from interstate pipelines. And so we have contracts that we buy gas, and we make sure we nominate and maintain enough availability and capacity on a given day based on the load that we forecast will achieve. And that's how we can provide reliable, affordable energy to our customers.
Because for us, we don't know. We just turn it on. It's there, but there's a lot that goes into getting it there. Customers can expect what? Any difference with Delta Utilities?
None at all. So they don't have to do anything. Their service will continue uninterrupted. Their bills will remain the same. We stepped into the shoes of Entergy, and prior to that, CenterPoint's rate regime, and they will begin receiving a bill this month from us from service that was provided beginning yesterday. So they don't have to do anything to continue their service. If they are enrolled in a paperless billing or an automated billing, they can go to www.deltautilities.com or call our number at 833-335-8299 or Delta 99, and we can assist them through that enrollment process if they so choose. But none of the customers have to take any initiative right now to maintain their service.
Tell me about advanced metering. How does that work?
Well, our metering process is such that we have a automated feed, a wireless feed from customers' homes and the meters that are there. so that we can read that remotely and don't have to go onto your property and send service technicians out to read meters all the time. So we can continually have a meter read to make sure that we have accurate billing process. So whether we receive that seed through internet or through driving trucks through neighborhoods, it's an automated continuous feed from our customers' meters.
Somebody texted in, said they live in a neighborhood that's all electric, no gas lines. Is there any way to get a gas line to the house?
Well, unfortunately, there are some neighborhoods that were built and contractors and developers that developed those neighborhoods chose not to put gas lines in that time. But, if a customer wants to call us and we can identify where our nearest gas service line is to that, we can see what we can do about running gas lines into a specific neighborhood.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. I'm going to talk about natural gas, too, in the future of it. Tim Poche, our guest, CEO of Delta Utilities. They're taking over the natural gas as a natural gas provider in New Orleans. I think they already have. 751, 9 till 8, traffic now, WWL. It is 7:54 and a half. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Tim Poche, CEO of Delta Utilities. They're taking over as the natural gas provider in Orleans Parish. Tell me about some technology and modernization opportunities that are available, Tim.
Yeah, so one of the things that we're really excited about associated with our business is that it's given us the opportunity to invest in a very modernized IT system that is centric to a natural gas-only utility. So we will be able to have touch points for the customers that are tailored to natural gas service. Things like track your technician. If a technician is supposed to come out to your home, we'll be able to give you a time in which they're coming, and you'll be able to know who's coming and when they're going to arrive. And it's a cloud-based technology, so it provides us the resiliency of making sure our system is up and running constantly. And also continually updated and as safe as it can be provided from cybersecurity threats. So very, very excited about the technology that we've put into play from that perspective.
Somebody texted in. I think it's a fair question. A lot of people have had whole house generators installed, gas generators since, Katrina, I guess, and just trying to remain mm-hmm. resilient. Does Delta have every enough gas, or I don't even know how to phrase the question, Tim, but enough volume to keep all the generators supplied when a hurricane strikes?
Good question, and yes is the short answer to that. It is important, though, that when you do install a natural gas generator in your home or any large gas appliance and change into your gas requirements, that you do contact us and make sure that you have the appropriate sized meter. It's one thing that we're very confident we can get the gas to your house and to your meter, but mm-hmm. if you don't have the right size meter, that could regulate the flow that you have to your home and to your natural gas generator. So I think that is very important. And if you follow the required permitting process through that should have happened to date. So the load that is caused by, natural gas generators that come on during hurricane season, obviously a very vital part of what of our communities here is not a very significant load in our overall specter of what we serve for large heating degree days. So very confident that we can deliver the amount of natural gas that our community would need in the event of widespread usage of these natural gas generators.
Yeah, that's the first I've heard of that, about the meter being the gate, I guess, if you will, to make sure that you have enough. So if it was installed according with a permit by a licensed person, that should have been taken care of. And if not, you're going to want to make sure that it is, right?
Absolutely. That is the number one complaint that we do have in times of storms when the generators are being utilized. The person hasn't fortunately, they hadn't had the need to use it, and their generator tries to kick on, and they realize that, you know, that they don't have the right sized meter there. And, you know, we don't expect them to know that. We just expect them to contact us and let us take care of that for you.
Talk about the reliability, if you will, of natural gas, Tim.
You know, it does, you know, the one amazing thing that, you know, we are acutely aware of in our community and in the climate that we have is that our infrastructure is underground, right? We're not battling with the elements of above ground transmission lines and distribution lines. So the fact that our infrastructure is underground provides, you know, that much more added resiliency. And we're not tied to any given generation plant for generating electricity. So we have abundant supplies of natural gas throughout the country, and especially in our region. We have the infrastructure to deliver it from the interstate pipelines to your home. And, you know, whether you're cooking or heating water or heating your home, you know, natural gas and the services that we can provide to facilitate that are always there.
Thank you, Tim. Appreciate your time. Tim Poche, CEO of Delta Utilities. Good luck. If y'all got any questions, you can always go to deltautilities.com for some FAQs, some transition updates, customer service information, or you can call 1-833-DELTA-99, 1-833-335-8299. We'll take a break. We come back. We'll talk to Ronald Surpass, as we do every Wednesday, about crime. Then we'll talk with Knox Ross with the Southern Rail Commission about this new New Orleans to Mobile train service. A lot coming up. Stay with us. To Ronald Surpass we go, professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD, superintendent, head of the Nashville City Police, Washington State Police, nationally known crime consultant. He'll pop up on cable TV every now and then as a guest, and he's with us this morning. How you doing, Chief?
Tommy, I'm wonderful, and it occurs to me as we are approaching July 4th, are you still riding Roman candles when they go off at night as part of your celebration?
I do, as a matter of fact. I rode one the other day across the river, as a matter of fact. Actually, you blew it. It was a surprise, but they were going to put me on one, and I was going to ride it across the river. And anyway.
That would have been great.
It would have,
yeah. Evel Knievel.
Yes. Let's talk about crime halfway through the year. I don't know how you measure crime and violent crime. As a superintendent, as a chief, how do you measure crime to see how you're doing in the first place?
Well, I'd like to make two completely different points about the same topic, and that's this. Crime can be measured, but public safety is something that people feel.
Okay.
So the government collects crime numbers of those reports given to the police by citizens or those crimes discovered by the police. In the mid-90s, we were driven by the crime data number, the ComStat models. We were driven, and you'd remember there was media complaints. If you were off by a tenth of a point in your calculations, you must have been fudging. And that's one way, is you just take the reports that are given to you, you find. The one that I found more interesting, and I have been this way for 20 years now, in 2005, we started doing satisfaction polling and safety polling by independent analysts every 6 months. 20 years ago, Tommy, we started that in Nashville, mm-hmm. June 2005. So what I could say to the community is the crime numbers being what they are with their warts and with their data is important. But what matters more to me as the chief is how do people feel about crime. So here in New Orleans, in the first 6 months of the year, crime numbers, the crime government captured data is going down. That's good news. But what would make me far more happy and interested is what we saw a couple weeks ago from Fauche's group that showed people were feeling safer. To me, Tommy, that's the one that matters. And finally, on that issue, it's the men and women in the police department. We talked about this, not the talking heads on TV, be they politicians, police chief, judges, whomever they may be. That doesn't affect the way people feel about crime. They get it from their friends, families, neighbors. And that individual NOPD officer that talks to somebody with dignity and respect is driving that increase in satisfaction that we're seeing. And that individual officer is driving people feeling safer. That's a success story, and we should be celebrating that the first 6 months of this year.
So murders are way down. Why?
Mm-hmm. there's always trends. And, you know, the scary thing about murders is that if a police chief could stop all murders, how many would we have? None. Mm-hmm. If a president or a governor could stop all murders, we would have none. So murder is an intimate crime between people. And the research experience in four decades of doing this, Tommy, most murders, overwhelmingly the ones that we can find everything out about them, are between people who knew each other in some way. That's very difficult to interrupt. Very difficult. It's sad. People die. I'm not trying to minimize it. So if you hitch your wagon to the murder rate as a police chief, now backing up into the politics of policing, if you hitch your wagon to the murder rate, how can you do that? Because if you could really stop them, there would be none. So you got to recognize the reality of that crime. The crime that chiefs hitch themselves to that I think makes a little more sense is the street incivilities, is the ability to interrupt burglary trends, the ability to interrupt drug dealing. Those are the kind of crimes where you're still up against people who want to do it no matter what the law is, but you have a little more push. And when murder goes down, we all should celebrate, to include the police.
So what happened with carjacking? Because it seems like for a while carjacking was just a scourge in the city. Now all of a sudden, not so much. What happened?
I have to tell you, Tommy, I've been around a long time. Criminals are dumb, but they're not stupid. Mm-hmm. Back in the 90s, carjacking exploded to the point where the legislature passed a brand new law. Everything old is new again. A bunch of young kids had decided this was going to be their strategy for crime. The legislature enacted a statute that would result in decades in prison. It went away because they're dumb, but they're not stupid. They recognize it's too dangerous. And I think you probably saw two things in the last couple of years around the country. One is you have an increase in the age cohort of children who are in that particular age group. And they saw carjacking, and then when they saw the outcome of their personal exposure to going to jail, and you saw the horrific tragedy of Miss Fricky and how the criminal justice system snapped immediately to fix that horrible problem of people thinking they could get away with carjacking, that's a little bit of what's driving carjacking, I think.
See, what's interesting about that is we're told sometimes when it comes to juveniles and crime, they're living life on the street, and they don't care about their own life, and they don't care about living or dying or prison or whatever. But you're telling me when it comes to carjacking, that's not necessarily the case.
I think it's been evidenced in my career that when a group of young people who are committing a certain crime realize the power of the government to hold them accountable, they will pick a different path. They don't want to go out and get to prison for the rest of their life. They'll find something else. And that doesn't apply to all cases. That's just a trend, right? And then you also have a number of kids that age that are dropping out, right? Birth rates. You think about what happened 20 years ago, and you start to get a little bit of a clearer picture. So predicting juvenile crime has a lot to do with what were the birth rates 18 years before this kid was born. Were there a lot of them? Were there fewer? And then the next thing is, again, they're dumb, but they're not stupid, right? They're not stupid. And finally, Tommy, the issue always boils down to this, your mom and them. If you tell your mom and them that you're going out to start your night at 16 years old at 1 o'clock in the morning, I think in policing we call that a clue. You got to have people raising their children, holding their children responsible. And we all got stories in our life about I didn't have this or I didn't have that. But you look in the poverty-stricken areas that I've policed, and those families that look after their kids with all the social economic criteria against them, those kids never get in trouble.
So just so I understand, when you're talking about carjacking, you're saying tougher penalties certainly did serve as a deterrent, right?
And the kids, I think it does. I think it does. They talk about it. They talk among each other. You know, one of the things you and I talked about a couple of years ago, when the police department is missing on its cylinders and they're not getting cases cleared quickly, believe me, Bob is calling Tom and say, man, did you hear George pulled off that robbery the other day? He's still walking the street. Maybe we can go do something. So obviously these criminals talk with one another. They follow the police's behavior. Career criminals, right? Career criminals watch the police activity as much as the police watch career criminal activity. It's a cat and mouse game.
All right, we'll take a break. Picking up, we come back. Talking to Ronald Surpass, professor of practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former head of three departments. You got any questions about crime or comments, 504-260-1870. That's the Oakland Art Jeweler Talk and text line. Please do not ever text and drive. 821 traffic now, WWL. 826 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with our friend Ronald Surpass, professor of practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD chief, head of the Washington State Police, Nashville City Police, just couldn't hold a job throughout his career. Anyway, so Chief, look, somebody wants to know about cameras and the pervasiveness of cameras throughout the area, if that's not a game changer when it comes to crime and the future of crime. And I'll piggyback on that because I'll watch TV programs from, you know, 70s, 80s, whatever, crime programs, and it's like, well, that wouldn't have happened. That wouldn't have happened. That wouldn't have happened because they'd have been on camera. Thoughts?
They're the most impressive thing that's helped us. Cameras that can take pictures outside of people's houses or in businesses or in public spaces are often what we need to bring cases for prosecution when some neighborhoods people cannot talk to the government because they're afraid of retaliation. It's made the huge difference. I noticed in the news last week there was some talk about facial recognition. Mm-hmm. The political leaders of any city need to let the science tell them, and I don't want to talk about COVID stuff, but the science on facial recognition is pretty much there now, right? Facial recognition is used at the TSA airports. It was used to identify all the January 6 rioters. Facial recognition has gotten better to the point where we don't think there's any inlaid bias. Once that happens, imagine the key is that I'm looking for Ronnie and I'm looking for Tommy. I don't know which one did the crime. I check video in the neighborhood, and then I see a picture, and I realize Tommy don't look nothing like Ronnie, so mm-hmm. I'm not looking for Tommy anymore. I think what happens when the political class starts arguing about facial recognition, they forget two really important things. One, no judge that I'm going to know of is ever going to sign a warrant just on facial recognition. You have to build the whole case. And secondly, why isn't it a great idea to eliminate people from police investigation so they're not getting the police knocking on their door at 2 o'clock in the morning when they have a piece of technology that can tell them DNA, fingerprints, or facial recognition say, we don't got to go to Mr. Jones's house tonight. It can't be him. Mm-hmm. So sometimes when these political groups get into these kind of conversations, we're reminded back to the very beginning of the conversation. We have long learned from research that people understand crime from friends, families, neighbors. They don't understand it from political leaders. That's just the facts.
When it comes to juvenile justice, ankle monitoring, mm-hmm. et cetera, we're going to talk to Andrew Waldron, lieutenant with NLPD's homicide unit, about ankle monitoring and a recent apprehension. Tell me about NLPD. Are they doing everything they can, as far as you know, when it comes to ankle monitoring?
I think as a nation, we're not doing as much as we can with ankle monitoring, usually for a host of reasons that have political overtones that have nothing to do with the technology. You have an ankle monitor essentially in your iPhone all day long, every day, and nobody gets wound up about that. The ankle monitors, when they're properly monitored, allow the police to understand if a person who's out of jail is in agreement with the court to not go someplace, right? That's the other thing that gets lost in the political noise. If you violate probations because you didn't do what you said you were going to do, the ankle monitor helps ensure that if the judge says, look, little Ron, you can't go to Louisiana Avenue and Claiborne anymore during this period of your trial, and I go, and my monitor says I was there, I broke the rules. Mm-hmm. It's a very good technology. It's a less expensive technology. And most importantly, we don't really need to lock kids up any longer than necessary if they're not terribly dangerous, but they were ones who need to continue their crime the prosecution. No, we need to do stuff like that. And I've done this for 4.5 years. And when politics infuses itself into anything other than politics, it tends to make the conversations in those other fields, policing, sports, academics, it just starts to really confuse people when they already know what they think they know. They don't need somebody to tell them a political spin.
Can't disagree with you there. Thank you, Ronald Surpass. Have a nice 4th of July. We'll take a break, come back, talk about Southern Rail, railway, what do you call it, a train, going from Mobile, New Orleans to Mobile and back again. Somebody texted in. I want to hear your thoughts on this on the Equinor Jeweler Talk and Text Line, 504-260-1870. Please do not text and drive. Every great employer records everything in the building. It proves who is innocent. Do you have a problem with cameras in your building, or would you have a problem with cameras in a building? Not in a restroom, of course, but just in a workspace to prove who did what, when, and recording everything? I think it'd be a good thing. I think it would protect everybody. Your thoughts at 504-260-1870. Minute late with apologies to WWL First News. 846, 14 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Making our way to the 4th of July weekend. A lot of people off, a lot of people getting ready. If you're traveling, be safe, be careful, please. Maybe you might want to go to Mobile. I got a way for you to do that. Knox Ross joins us now, chairman of the Southern Rail Commission. How you doing, Knox?
I'm doing great. How about you, Tommy?
I'm okay, sir. Tell me what you're here to talk about.
Well, we're here to talk about that starting on August the 18th, You'll have twice daily service to Mobile and the Mississippi coast from downtown New Orleans.
So tell me how it works. You go to the downtown station, right? The Union Passenger Terminal. Is that what it's still called or not? Yeah.
That's right. N-O-U-P-T. New Orleans Union Passenger Terminal, right by the Superdome, right by the Hyatt.
Plenty of parking. You park there, you hop on the train, yep. Then you can go to where?
You can go to Bay St. Louis, Gulfport, Biloxi, Pascagoula, or Mobile.
All right. What happens when I get off of the train there?
Well, you know, in Bay St. Louis, more than likely somebody will pick you up in a golf cart, hand you a Bloody Mary, and you know, take you to your hotel or your Airbnb. You know, that place is incredible. Yesterday, they had everybody dressed up in all their Mardi Gras outfits. It was a big party. I mean, they're just so excited to welcome folks to Bay St. Louis.
And that's what I wanted to ask you as it relates to golf carts and those kind of things. You yeah. made arrangements with the businesses there, give me the cities again. I had in front of me, but I lost them.
Well, it's Bay St. Louis,
Gulfport, Biloxi, yeah. Pascagoula, and then in Mobile. You've had
– And Mobile. They're working on that. Mm-hmm. I actually talked to a young lady yesterday that's working on getting the – I think she's got to get a little bit of sponsorship to be able to provide it. But, you know, Bay St. Louis has official – licensure for golf carts and that sort of thing. And, you know, the great thing about all these cities is they're eminently walkable. Mm-hmm. And also they have great Uber and like Coast Transit covers, Gulfport, Biloxi, and they, it's easy to get around. You don't need a car. And I think that's what's unique about this little stretch of track compared to most everywhere else in the country is that every stop you have, you don't have to have a car. You get off the train right in the middle of downtown, and all of these downtowns have flourished after Katrina. I mean, they're just in great shape and well worth visiting.
I've never been on a train. I hate to tell you that, Knox, but I've never have been. I know my kid went one time with somebody to Chicago, but I was not on that trip. Tell me about the accommodation. Tell you what, let me take a break here. I just noticed the time. Let me take a break, and then we'll come back. We'll talk about the accommodations, the prices, et cetera. It starts on August the 18th. I think it'd be a lot of fun, actually, just go park at the Union Passenger Terminal, hop on a train, go to Bay St. Louis, Gulfport, Biloxi, Pascagoula, or Mobile. And also, I don't know if it's like in the old days where you, on the movies that you see, where you can keep buying your ticket. If you don't decide you don't go to Pascagoula, keep going to Mobile, just pay it more money. 850, 10 till 9, traffic now, WWL. 8:54 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Knox Ross, chairman of the Southern Rail Commission. Starting on August 18th, you'll be able to take a train from New Orleans to Mobile, but you can stop before that. And, Knox, I was wondering, do I have to decide where I'm going when I get on the train, or can I, on the way there, decide, well, you know what, I'm having such a good time, I don't want to get off at Bay St. Louis, I want to go to Gulfport, Biloxi, and beyond. Can you keep buying tickets, or how's that work?
You can get on the app and buy tickets to wherever you want to go.
Okay.
You know, you would start off buying a ticket, say, to Biloxi, and you want to go to the casino or something, and you say, okay, I'm tired of that. You can just buy a ticket from Biloxi or I'm sure on the train you can buy one, keep on going. We'll sell all the tickets we can.
Tell me what's going to be like on the train once I get on it.
Well, they had a couple of cars that'll be used on the train yesterday at New Orleans. And so these are traditional passenger cars that have been refurbished. They're really nice. And, you know, they're two and two seating. So you don't have any middle seats. The seat itself is about the size of a first class seat on an airliner. And, you know, got a foot rest, plenty of leg room. So you'll have two of those cars. Plus, you'll have a cafe car with some booth seating that people can use, anybody can use. And then in the very back of that will be what's called business class, which has leather seating, a little bit bigger, cushier seats, and then has, you know, free drink and stuff from the cafe car.
Somebody asked, and I hate to pass this along, but about security on a train. I guess people are worried about all kinds of different things. There is security on a train, right?
Oh, absolutely. Amtrak has its own police force, and they have several officers based out of New Orleans. that take care of whatever problems arise.
So how many trips a day leave or start on August the 18th? I'm just trying to get my mind wrapped around this. And then when do they leave the different areas? Like, what are they, different time? One a day, a couple a day, or what?
Well, so there'll be a morning departure out of New Orleans. I think it's about 6:20 that goes to Mobile. There'll mm-hmm. be an evening departure out of New Orleans late in the afternoon, maybe 5 or so. I don't have the schedule in front of mm-hmm. me, that goes to Mobile, and vice versa. So there's a morning train out of Mobile, a morning train out of New Orleans. So if you say, I want to go to the aquarium in Gulfport, mm-hmm. I can ride the train over to Gulfport. Aquarium's about 3 blocks away. You can walk down there. There's a circulator, whatever. You can enjoy the day with your family at the aquarium, not have to worry about car, not have to worry about driving I-10, then get back on the train that evening and ride back to New Orleans. And vice versa, there's a lot of people who are talking about, I can go spend a nice day in the quarter, a nice day, you know, anywhere in New Orleans, and then come back that night. Or it's a nice overnight where you can get up that next morning and go back to your office or home and not, you know, spend a whole day trying to get back home.
So the trip is from New Orleans to Mobile, and it stops at all of those places in Mississippi. Somebody says, can you buy a ticket to Mobile, get off at Pass Christian for a few hours, and then get back on and continue to Mobile later? Well, I guess the answer would be no, because it's only 2 times a day, once at 6:20, once in the afternoon, right?
Well, I mean, in essence, you could, because there'll be another train going that way that afternoon. You just have to spend a day there.
Right,
I mean,
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, so you can spend a day there, sure. I mean, it's you could say, I want to go hop around the coast a little bit. Okay, you could buy a ticket that morning and go on to Biloxi. Get off at Biloxi. You're right by the Coast Transit if you want to use them. You got Uber running everywhere. You could run over to Ocean Springs, let's just say. And we're working with CTA to try to put together something that's a circulator over to Ocean Springs from the train. And you can spend the day in Ocean Springs. You say, well, you know, this afternoon I want to head on over to Mobile, stay at the Battle House or the Admiral or something, mm-hmm. have a nice dinner, some drinks. So you could get back on the afternoon train going to the east and do just that. And then the next morning or afternoon, if you want to spend the day in Mobile, get back on the afternoon train, come back to New Orleans. So having those 2 trains a day, which we haven't had in 50 or 60 years, if that, is the real game changer for the service, is that it gives you multiple options, multiple stops. You don't even have to spend the night anywhere to go have a nice day out away from the city, or for people to come into the city.
Give me a site where people can go find out more about this, buy their tickets, etc.
Amtrak.com. There's a placeholder that says Amtrak Mardi Gras service. You can't miss it.
All right. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Good luck. Knox Ross, thank chairman you. Of the Southern Rail Commission. We come back, we're going to talk to Walter Dub Lane about the effects of the big, beautiful bill on the Louisiana healthcare delivery system. Stay tuned. 9:08 now on this Wednesday morning, and I got a text earlier from somebody that said, I'm a regular listener to WWL. WWL is a massive listening audience, well-respected media outlet in southern Louisiana. Big, beautiful bill is going to hammer the crap out of hundreds of thousands of Louisiana citizens. I would hope that WWL would denounce those senators and representatives who supported this dreadful bill. And if anyone wants to pretend that this wasn't passed for the rich, then they have buried their heads in the sand. There's no justification at all. Thank you. Well, thank you for texting in. But to be fair to us, we have looked at all different sides of the big, beautiful bill and who it's going to hurt and who it's going to help. I started at 6 o'clock talking with a professor of political science at Hamline University and recounted the story of my neighbor, who is on Social Security and was strictly against the big, beautiful bill because of it increasing the debt and deficit, until he realized that there was no taxes on Social Security. And at that point, he did a flip-flop and said he was 100% for it. So I guess in a lot of ways, sometimes it depends on who does it help and who does it hurt. Sometimes people, though, don't know what helps them and what hurts them. With that in mind, Walter Dub Lane joins us, an associate professor of economics and finance at my alma mater, UNO, to talk about Medicaid cuts in the big, beautiful bill and what that means. Good morning, Dub. How are you?
Oh, good morning, Connor.
I'm sure this is pretty simple stuff we're going to go through, right?
Yeah, not quite.
So let's.
I mean, this is, you know, this is a fairly complicated issue.
So I don't know how you're a professor. You tell me the best way to present the material, Dub. I'm going to give you let you create the syllabus. Is it? Do we start with who gets Medicaid and who's dependent on it, and who this could hurt and what the cuts could mean? You take it.
Well, again, for especially in Louisiana, because under Governor Edwards, we did do the Medicaid rollout that increased the number of people. We have a greater percentage of Louisiana people on Medicaid than any other state in the union.
Let me slow down for a second, Dub. When you say Medicaid rollout and it increased the number of people on Medicaid, what did that result in? Did that mean that people that could have afforded insurance, that could have had their own insurance, decided to lay on the leg of the taxpayers with Medicaid? Does it mean that people that didn't have insurance or didn't have medical care before got it? Tell me what that meant.
The answer is yes and yes.
Okay.
That most of the people that got it, what happened was this was a part of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, that they were, the purpose of Obamacare was to, the main purpose was to get more people on insurance, and it did it two ways. One, by basically saying anybody that has is up to 138% of the federal poverty line, and for a family of four, that's around $35,000 now. Anybody that's has an income in that range will automatically be qualified for Medicaid. Under the old rules in Louisiana, pretty much the only people that were on Medicaid were very, very poor people below the poverty line, and mostly had to be women with dependent children. That was about the only people on Medicaid. So once they did the Medicaid rollout through Obamacare, that, you know, increased by about 500,000 people, the people that got onto Medicaid in Louisiana. Now, some of those people were working for companies where they had insurance, and they dropped their insurance and did it. But I think the numbers I've seen on that are only about 10%, whatever. There was an effect of some people that actually did it, but the vast majority had no insurance and now have it.
So what happened to that vast majority before the Medicaid expansion? What were they doing for medical care before, and now what's going to happen after the big, beautiful bill? Because in between, they had Medicaid, right?
Right. They had Medicaid. And again, the estimates that I've seen in Louisiana is about 120,000, maybe as much as twice as that, will probably lose their Medicaid. Interestingly enough, not completely because of the cuts, but because of the work requirement. Because it turns out the vast majority of people on Medicaid, you know, there are exceptions to that. What would qualify for Medicaid under the new rules, the problem is you have to document it. So you have to be working at least, 80 hours a month. But the problem is to be able to document it, you've got to have pay stubs, or if you're an Uber driver, you can prove that you're how many hours you're working. And many of these people can't come up with the documentation. Mm-hmm. It's not that they're not meeting the criteria, but this interesting thing to notice, Arkansas did this a couple of years ago, the same thing that the federal government's doing now. And what they found out is a lot of people lost their Medicaid, and when they went back in and researched them, they found out most of them actually qualified for Medicaid, but they just couldn't prove it. And so it ended. And furthermore, the worst part of that was in Arkansas, at least the people that studied it, you know, the whole purpose was to get some of the people that could be, that should be working back working. There was no increase in employment due to this rule in Arkansas. So it's one of those things that sounds good when you say it. Yes, we want these people who are able-bodied people to be able to work, because there are exceptions. Women taking care of little children, they're not required to meet this, or taking care of elderly patients or the infirm, things of that sort. There's lots of exceptions. But they're saying, well, you got able-bodied people that aren't working. Well, there turns out there aren't very many of those. Mm-hmm. So this idea of sounds really good, but in practice it doesn't seem to be working the way it's supposed to. So again, so those people, back to the original question, if they don't have Medicaid, what do? The answer is mostly they don't get much in the way of care, except for there are free clinics around, federally qualified health institutions that treat them, and they go to the emergency room. Now, it turns out, but now that they have Medicaid, many of them are able to go to a primary care physician and get more routine care. And this is really a big deal, because if they don't have any care at all, they go to the emergency room. When they do get sick, they often are very sick, and fixing them up is much harder to do. So that's probably where we're going to. There may be a large number in Louisiana, say estimates up to 100, 120,000 or more that might be having insurance right now under Medicaid, and then they won't have it.
Okay, so at what time, what's the time frame on all of that? Do you have any idea yet? Does this bill specify that, or do you know?
Actually, that's a good question. I mean, of course, now it hasn't. Remember, we still
have to pass.
It's got to go back to the House. It's got to go back to the House, but the House has got to pass something. We're pretty sure that's all this. And the Senate bill is much harder on Medicaid than the House bill was. And so I don't know. I don't know that actually the implementation deadline.
I guess, the question,
but I'm sure it'll be. I'm sure it takes a couple of months. But part of the problem is now all the Medicaid officials have to be trained in how to do all of these. Work requirement type of things. So they, you know, right now we don't have anybody checking that. Now to check it is going to be a real problem.
So the idea behind the work requirement was to make sure that, because they're getting Medicaid anyway, I don't understand how working helps decrease the amount of Medicaid that they receive, does it?
They may be working now on Medicaid, but maybe they'll move up, you know, in the company to a point where they don't need Medicaid anymore. That's kind of the philosophy behind it.
Okay.
People that are able to work first should be working. And then secondly, hopefully some of them will work their way out off of Medicaid.
That's what I was trying to figure out, what the reason was there.
Yeah.
Because the same people would still be getting Medicaid. They'd just be working, right? Unless you didn't work,
again,
then you wouldn't get Medicaid.
Like you say, all the evidence we've seen is the vast majority of people that are on Medicaid are working. They just in very low-paying jobs that don't provide, or you know, part-time jobs or gig work or things like that don't provide insurance, and so they don't buy it. And this is how they. But they're also low enough income that they qualify for Medicaid, at least under the Obamacare rules.
So that's from the demand side. What about from the supply side? How would that affect health care in Louisiana?
Well, again, this is the other big problem. I was talking to people at hospitals that are saying they're now trying to figure out what services they're going to cut when this goes through, knowing that the hospitals are going to be losing income because right now they don't get much off of, especially rural hospitals. Let's talk about rural hospitals. That's the big ones. Rural hospitals actually get paid fairly good for Medicaid patients as opposed to the community hospitals who get paid very poorly. But if all those same patients that they're now getting paid for all of a sudden don't have insurance anymore, they'll still be going to the hospital, but now they will be uninsured patients, and therefore the income of the rural hospitals are going to be going down. And the rural hospitals operate right now on very thin margins to begin with. So there's a prediction that there may be hundreds of hospitals across the country. I've heard estimates as many as 20 or 30 in the state of Louisiana that might close because of this.
So,
and then you've got health care issues with everybody in those rural parishes.
So I'm not trying to be stupid here. How are we defining a rural hospital?
I don't actually know the actual definition, but it's usually, these are mostly hospitals have 25 beds, you know, that type of thing. And just, of course, located in, they're not in major cities or stuff, but it's really small hospitals.
So
is what you're talking about.
When they if they close, that means the people that were dependent on them do what?
Well, they drive a lot farther to get to another hospital. And you've got to drive right now, you're driving, 15 or 20 minutes to get to the hospital. Now you have to drive over an hour to get to the hospital. Some people won't go as often. And even if they do, for certain types of things, time is important getting to the hospital. So there will probably, and again, it's not just the ones that are now uninsured, but it's everybody else that uses those hospitals now won't have a hospital.
Somebody texted in and said, I thought part of the issue on Medicaid was that over 7 million men were on Medicaid rolls and the U.S. government was picking 90% of the cost. Many of those men were able to work and were not. Do you have any idea if that's true or not?
I haven't seen evidence of that.
Okay.
I mean, what I've seen says that there's not nearly that many that fit that category.
And again, whenever you start talking about politics and people making up this, making up that, who knows where the truth is. Somebody wants to know about seniors and disabled in nursing homes. Does this have anything to do with any of that?
Well, yes, because most people in nursing homes, almost half of the people in nursing homes are there on Medicaid. And so I've seen some, I've been looking a little bit into how it affects Medicaid. This has to do with the other part of it, which is called the provider fees. I can say it really gets complicated.
But that's all right. That's where the trouble is in the details. Go ahead.
Yeah, that hospitals right now in Louisiana and most other places, states, basically give fees to the state Department of Health, who uses that money to get Medicaid match. Because for some patients, Medicaid pays $9 for every dollar we do. So if the hospitals give them $1 million, that turns into $10 million, and which then gets fed back to the hospitals and support them. Now they've cut the Medicaid provider fees. Right now it's, over the next 5 or 6 years, those fees are going to be cut in half of how much they can give. And so that will lower the total amount of money in the Medicaid budget for the state, which will then affect everybody. Now, the nursing homes are in a slightly different category. Their provider fees have not been cut, so they won't be affected as much by that. But the nursing homes will be affected by this because, again, for many of them, half of their patients are Medicaid patients.
So let me take a break. We're going to pick it up here specifically when it comes to because I'm getting a lot of text on nursing homes and Medicaid, and we can talk about the spending down requirements and so forth and if any of that changes or not. Dublane's our guest, Walter Dublane, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at UNO. Every action has a reaction. We're talking about what? The Big Beautiful Bill, which has not passed yet but has gone back to the House and is now in conference and ultimately will, in one way or the other, you would think, reach the president's desk and be signed. What that'll mean for the health care delivery system in Louisiana. You got any questions or comments? 504-260-1870. Don't text and drive. And I'll pass those questions along when we come back on WWL. All right, here's back with Walter Dublane, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at UNO. Let me clean this up because I said no taxes on Social Security. First of all, no bill has been passed or signed yet. Secondly, I was going by what my neighbor told me. That was based on a conversation of picking up the garbage cans. He was going by what President Trump said. It's like a game of telephone, which is no taxes on Social Security. However, the Senate proposal includes a temporary $6,000 deduction for seniors over the age of 65. The House proposal, a temporary deduction of $4,000. But it's not, as President Trump said, no tax on Social Security. So I just wanted to clean that up.
Yep. Okay,
Lau. Let's move on to nursing homes with what's going on with spending down, what Medicaid pays for. I don't think people that haven't been there yet with parents or whatever understand exactly how important Medicaid is to the nursing home industry. Thoughts?
Well, again, because, first of all, just to remember that Medicare doesn't pay for what we consider traditional nursing home care. Medicare only pays for what's called convalescent care. If you've been in the hospital and you need to go to the nursing home for a month or so to recover, Medicare pays for that, but they don't pay for long-term care for things like Alzheimer's and stuff like that. So that's, most people think of seniors getting their aid through Medicare. That doesn't cover most nursing home care. So there's two ways to pay for it. You pay for it out of the pocket. We're talking about $80,000 a year many times for nursing home care. That pretty much drains most people's pockets pretty quickly. Or to qualify for Medicaid, you've got to be poor. And poor includes not only your income, but also your savings. That's where you come up with the spend down rule. That there's a rule that says you have to pay for the nursing home yourself until you spend enough of your savings so that you're now qualified for Medicaid to take over. That's the spend down rule.
Different when it comes to assets, when it comes to a house, I believe there is a provision if there is a surviving spouse, a surviving spouse can keep the house?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a number of restrictions to that in general. In particular, one, if you have a surviving spouse, then that affects how much you have to spend down. And certainly the house is protected.
Unless it's there is no surviving spouse, then, and now we're getting into usufruct and everything else here, but then you have to divest yourself of that house. Is it 3 or 4 years before you anticipate going into a nursing home so it doesn't count against you?
Yeah, that's called the look-back rule.
Okay.
The other thing you can't do is knowing you're coming up to that and start giving $50,000 to each of your three kids, right before you try to qualify. They look back at what you're at what you've done in terms of your assets, but in particular that and that. So you can't do that.
Which means
try to give your money away. So now you qualify.
And then that leads people to think, and I'm just being practical here. Some people want their parents to sign the house over to them so it stays in the estate like 3 or 4 years, maybe if they're anticipating a nursing home down the line, which they can do, I believe, but a lot of parents are hesitant to do that, right?
Yeah, and again, I don't know the exact rules and all that. I just know the general principles involved.
So with that being said, does this bill affect any of that, Dub, as far as you know?
I don't think it affects that. This is all just about the two main principles that were affecting Medicaid were this work. There's a total cut in Medicaid funding. There's also, but the biggest cut has to do with what we anticipate happening with this work requirements. And then the other one are these provider fee rules. Those are the main characteristics that affect Medicaid, as I understand it.
So to try to simplify this a little bit, we're talking about a pool of how many people, again, depending on what version of the bill goes through, approximately how many people in Louisiana will be tossed off of the Medicaid rolls, and if so, what do they do?
Again, the estimates I've seen start at about 120,000, maybe up to twice as much of that. And again, they will then become, unless they, if they get tossed off and then they can go back and prove, yes, they are working and then get back on. Mm-hmm. And because I can say a lot of them do qualify, they just can't prove it, or they haven't been able to prove it. So again, they become uninsured. If they become uninsured, they either have to go to free clinics or they go to the emergency room for most of their care.
How does this relate to Obamacare at all or the health care delivery system in the nation with affordable health care? Does that affect this at all?
Well, I mean, again, it affects Obamacare because in Louisiana, we took advantage of the Obamacare rollout, Governor Edwards did, and that increased the number of people in Louisiana. We have about 1.5 million people, 30% of our total population on Medicare right now. We've cut back a little bit because, well, how do we get it? There was a big expansion during the pandemic, and we cut back a number of people that no longer qualified under those rules. But still, we have we're expected of 1.5 million. They're talking about maybe 100,000, a little bit more, that might lose their Medicaid.
And let me go a step back. The money for Medicaid comes from where?
Well, again, there's two buckets. The traditional Medicaid, which is people that qualified under the old rules before Obamacare, in Louisiana, the federal government pays about 2/3 of the expense, and the state pays 1/3. In other words, for every dollar the state pays, Medicaid pays 2 more from the federal government. For the newly qualified people, under the 500,000 that are qualified under the new Obamacare rules, the federal government pays for 90% of those people. So for every dollar that the state pays, the federal government kicks in $9. Now that's about 1/3 of our population that meets the new rules. 2/3 were still under the old rules.
Mm-hmm. So if you had to predict, and I know you've been involved with hospitals and you study this for your life's work, what the result of this Medicaid contraction, if I can call it that, would be on the state, it would be what?
Well, again, you're going to have people that are losing their insurance, okay? And if they lose their insurance, we've got some documents, their health care will go down. They won't be able to be getting the routine types of visits. And so the biggest effect is on the people that are losing their health insurance. But the other effect is on the providers, that hospitals are now trying to figure out. I wouldn't say this is a likely one, but for instance, they might decide, a hospital might decide that they're no longer going to deliver babies because it turns out labor and delivery happens to have a high Medicaid component to it. Mm-hmm. And so we say, well, since we're losing money on that anyway, now we're going to lose more money. I won't do that anymore. So hospitals might be cutting certain services that are heavily Medicaid dependent. The biggest worry, though, is the hospitals that are closing, particularly these rural hospitals where you might have 40 or 50% of their population are on Medicaid.
And my concern is you can only shove so much stuff into a pipe. And with that analogy being said, if people aren't getting the preventative care that they need through Medicare, they're going to wind up going to hospitals in emergency rooms, and as a result, that gets passed on to us or not?
Yes. In some ways, it's very indirect. But what's traditionally happened is that the people that have insurance end up paying a little bit more in order to keep the hospitals open, because Blue Cross, can't. Insured people at the hospitals close. So they kind of subsidize that. But their subsidy comes through our higher insurance premiums for everybody that has insurance.
Is this analogous to putting a Band-Aid on the healthcare system, delivery system in a country?
Well, I think it's more like ripping off one.
Okay.
So
ripping off the Band-Aid, not putting one on, and then you still got the gaping wound.
Yeah,
thank you.
Medicaid's kind of a Band-Aid to begin with, and now you're ripping it off. Now you're just you have an open sore.
Thank you, Dub. Appreciate your time, as always, and your expertise. Walter Dub Lane, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at my alma mater, UNO. It's complicated. Nobody wants waste. Nobody wants anything for free. But again, there's only so much stuff you can shove into a tube, and at some point, it's going to come squirting out, and the question is, who winds up paying for it when it comes squirting out? That's a layman's example of that. 9:37, we'll talk to NOPD about ankle monitoring when we come back. Traffic now, WWL. All right, 9:44, 16 till 10. We welcome in Lieutenant Andrew Waldron of the NOPD Homicide Unit. But, Lieutenant, I got to warn you, we got some kind of breaking news with P. Diddy or something. I'm probably going to have to interrupt you at one point around 50 and then come back to you, okay?
Yes, sir. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Well, thank you. It's good to talk to you, and I appreciate all the work you do. Let's talk about Leroy Johnson, I think, is the guy's name. I just want to get the truth out there, because we talked to Dennis, Matt Dennis with ASAP, and he said one thing, and I know you guys have a different angle on it, or a different view of it. Tell me the story, or at least tell me about Leroy Johnson, ankle monitoring, and so forth. Lieutenant, I'll let you have the floor.
Yes, sir. First of all, I just want to say that, we have great success with our investigations, and it's through our collaboration with our partners, whether it be in the private sector or with the state, federal, and local partners. ASAP is a very pivotal partner with us. We've worked with them. We need them, and they need us. And so there's been a little bit of confusion. I'm not going to go tit for tat here. But, mm-hmm. From the homicide perspective, Deputy Aples was killed early Sunday morning on the 22nd. We were able to get some surveillance footage on Monday, the next day, the 23rd, and we were able to see that the person of interest had an ankle monitor on their leg. I've had Miss Jill Dennis come to my units and train us, and we have access to OmniLink, which is the geolocation service, which allows us to put in locations and see if there are any offenders being monitored in that location. Mm-hmm. That is a common practice for both the homicide division and for all the other investigative units. Anytime we have an armed robbery, a shooting, a murder, it's common practice that we run a proximity report. And what that means is we put in a location. In this case, it was at the intersection, near the intersection of Morrison and Downman. We put that location into, at the time, what we thought was their only system, and it's the only system we have access to, the devices themselves, into the OmniLink system. We didn't get any hits from the proximity report, which would put the subject on the scene.
Let me slow down a little bit, Lieutenant. I'm trying to keep track of this. So you saw the video. He was wearing an ankle monitor, right?
That's right, sir.
And then from there, what happened?
So it's common practice, whether we have that video or not, for every case we investigate, we run a geolocation proximity report via OmniLink, which is a system ASAP has given us access to and has trained us on.
So if it's at Canal and Broad Street or whatever it is, I don't know, pick a street. If it's there, then if that's where the incident occurs, then you go to this proximity locator to see if anybody is under a monitor in that area. I got that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir. We would put in maybe 500 or 1,000 feet circumference.
I got you.
And it would give you locations and how many times it's hit at what times. So we were kind of stumped, to be honest. There's a couple other providers in the area. We reached out to them on Monday. and we didn't get anything back as to if it would be them. As a testament to our working relationship with ASAP, on Tuesday we emailed them and said, hey, we're kind of stumped here. Do you have any advice on, you know, how, who might be monitoring this device? Because at this point, we didn't know who this subject was. If we knew who he was, obviously we would have approached it a little differently, but we didn't know who he was. Mm-hmm. And ASAP responded to us later with a screenshot, which included Jeroy Johnson's information and the pings from his ankle monitor, which put him on the scene corroborating the video surveillance footage. Mm-hmm. What was interesting, though, is the screenshot was of a system none of us had ever seen. So that's when we called ASAP directly. We have good working relationships, like I said, and I want to keep them that way. Mm-hmm. And they informed us that there was a separate system called the TRAC system, where they had 121 of their most violent offenders on this system, but we don't have access to it. None of us had ever heard of it at this point. Which was very surprising, to be honest, because we do have a very transparent relationship, and it's a relationship that I want to keep, and I want to keep fostering, because whatever collaborative effects that we have together to make investigations stronger and quicker to bring justice to families, is that's our goal. So once we found this information out, you know, we were told that we have to come to ASAP, and we confirmed that Jeroy Johnson was on the scene of this murder. And this was him in this video. I myself personally went to ASAP and met with their employees and confirmed this information with my own eyes. Immediately contacted our violent offender warrant squad and the U.S. Marshals. And within 2 hours of me getting to their location, he was in custody. He had seen himself on the news that day and had fled. He fled to Slidell and was kind of hiding out in a wooded area and kind of picked up on law enforcement and tried to flee. He was arrested without incident. Again, within 2 hours, once we learned of this system. Now, ASAP had talked. Do you get to a break, sir?
I do, Lieutenant. Tell you, you're savvy, man. I'm telling you, you're listening to music and you know. So let's pick it up there when we come back, all right? And also, I want to know, with going forward, is NOPD going to have access to that second monitoring system track? And I got a couple of other questions as well. We're talking about the identification of Jeroy Johnson, who is charged with killing that Jefferson Parish Sheriff's officer. And we're talking to Lieutenant Andrew Walden with the Homicide Unit. We'll get back to him in a second. But first, we pause for some breaking news here from CBS about the P. Diddy verdict. And then we'll be back here on WWL. All right, Lieutenant, apparently we're on a different tracking system as well. So tell me about now, where were you when you interrupted yourself? I'm sorry about that.
So again, this is a system that we don't have access to. We weren't even aware that it existed, and which is, it's odd, honestly, because again, we do have a great working relationship with ASAP. Ms. Jill Dennis has my number. We speak regularly regarding a whole number of issues. And to learn that 121 of the most violent individuals that they monitor on that was kind of disturbing, to be honest. To hear Mr. Dennis again last night or on your show talk about how we can't have access because of the law, and then he said our policy restricts us. You know, again, I'm looking.
So, what is the key, Lieutenant, to having access to track? Is it proprietary, or is it something that NOPD would have to pay for?
Sure.
Or something?
I do know that the system that we do have access to, which until last week we were under the impression it was the only system ASAP used. We can run a geolocation report and only have access to that information, then we have to request that they open up the individual who's being monitored to us after we locate them in the geolocation report. From my understanding is that the other system may not be able to be restricted to that. It would just be wide open access. So we need to work together to find a common ground here where, you know, maybe one or two people might have access to it because we can't run a geolocation report. And my concern is that, you know, they have 121 individuals who are their most violent offenders on this system. Mm-hmm. Maybe we've missed some in the past because we didn't know it existed before last week. So again, you know, immediately upon finding this out, We've worked with Ms. Jill Dennis to try and set up training with NOPD in the coming weeks to train on their database that they have, and they're very they push that a lot. And look, it's no secret here that they are a for-profit business. They have a product that they offer. It's very good. They have a very good product. They're not the only ankle monitoring service in this area, but they're one of the largest. And they're pushing for legislation that all individuals who are on ankle monitors have to be registered in some database. And conveniently, it's a database they have already established. And if that's the way that this goes, so be it. I mean, that's business. And I'm not knocking them for that. But we need to know which systems that they have in place for us to be able to run geolocation reports for individuals for when these violent crimes happen. There's no reason in today's age that someone should be monitored by an ankle monitor and the police cannot run a geolocation report and find out who it is.
Lieutenant, let me jump in here.
If we don't have the video surveillance, we don't see that this individual has a monitor on his leg.
To begin with, right. You know, let me just ask you this, just from a layman's standpoint. You know, people are wondering about, you know, location report, and that's all after the fact. Is there any way that NOPD or anybody could actively, is there not the manpower for that, to monitor if somebody violates their probation, go pick them up before they kill somebody, or is that not possible?
Well, we would have to know of that. I mean, I think that's a lot of these things that we have to work forward through. The only way we have access, we have geolocation access. So current, you know, if something happens outside, like you said earlier, Broad and Canal, we would run Broad and Canal and then it would tell us. ASAP has the ability to look at all individuals live. We don't. Uh-huh. And I think that's the problem with their other system that they're using. And now they're using multiple systems, is that they can't restrict the access to that system.
Thank you, Lieutenant. I appreciate your time. You're welcome anytime. Lieutenant Andrew Waldron, Homicide Unit, NOPD. We'll take a break, find out what Newell's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.